I continue to be a team player. They know I'm on the right team. I'm doing the right thing. I'm protecting who I need to protect. You know I'll continue to stay in good graces in Trump world. And they have reminded me a couple of times that Trump does read transcripts. And just keep that in mind as I proceed through my interviews with the committee. Here's another sample in a different context. This is a call received by one of our witnesses. Quote, a person let me know you have your deposition tomorrow. He wants me to let you know he's thinking about you. He knows you're loyal and you're going to do the right thing when you go in for your deposition. I think most Americans know that attempting to influence witnesses to testify untruthfully presents very serious concerns.
And we end with Donald Trump's former national security advisor, General Mike Flynn, who supported Trump's efforts to overturn the election. During Tuesday's hearing, the House committee aired excerpts of its video deposition with Flynn, who repeatedly refused to answer questions from House committee Vice Chair Liz Cheney.
Do you believe the violence on January 6th was justified morally?
Take the Fifth.
You believe the violence on January 6th was justified legally?
Fifth.
General Flynn, do you believe in the peaceful transition of power in the United States of America?
The Fifth.
The Fifth, so said President Trump's former national security advisor, General Mike Flynn, in videotape testimony. He was answering the questions of committee vice chair, Congressmember Liz Cheney. If you want to see the full surprise hearing yesterday that lasted about 2 hours with Cassidy Hutchinson with various deposition testimony like Mike Flynn, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, 80 Oregon inmates protest their treatment with a hunger strike. Wildfire season begins with a 40,000-acre fire in eastern Oregon. And new testimony from the January 6th Commission lends more evidence to Trump's involvement with the insurrection. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. Some 80 people inside Oregon's only federal prison have been on a hunger strike protesting conditions inside the facility. The hunger strike is taking place in the detention center at the Federal Correctional Institution in Sheridan. It includes a medium security prison, currently with 980 inmates, an adjacent detention center with 215 inmates, and a minimum security satellite camp with 309 inmates. Bureau of Prison spokesperson Benjamin O'Cone said, quote, numerous inmates assigned to the detention center at Federal Correctional Institution Sheridan did not accept meals prepared by the Bureau of Prisons for several days. However, during this time, these inmates had access to purchase goods from the commissary for consumption, end quote. O'Cone said the prisoners are currently accepting their meals. But one inmate said the prisoners only started accepting food after the prison had threatened to shut off water to their cells. The action came as more than three dozen inmates filed a petition seeking reduction of their sentences, citing 2 years of alleged unconstitutional conditions. Lisa Hay, the federal public defender, has filed dozens of habeas corpus petitions seeking people's release over concerns about poor medical care and inmates spending entire weekends locked in their cells. Her court filings have detailed reports received from people inside, including patients with cancer who have not received treatment for months, and inmates who have attempted suicide because they did not receive their medication or the mental health treatment they requested. Hayes said, quote, we continue to be extremely concerned about the conditions experienced by people incarcerated at the federal prison in Sheridan, Oregon. The Federal Public Defender's Office represents people seeking release from custody because the conditions are so harsh as to be unconstitutional. We had hoped that the existence of these lawsuits would spur reforms within the Bureau of Prisons, but any progress over these last 2 years has been frustratingly slow, end quote. At least six inmates have died at Sheridan since March of 2020. None of the deaths were reported as being from COVID-19. Workers at a Lincoln City hospital have improved their union contract. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
Workers at a hospital on the Oregon coast are citing a victory in contract negotiations with their employer. More than 100 members of SEIU Local 49 at Samaritan North Lincoln Hospital in Lincoln City will receive raises averaging 10% over the first year of their new contract. Brittany King is a CT special imaging technologist at the hospital. She says many workers have been struggling to afford living in the community, and this raise makes the hospital's wages competitive with the local job market.
There are a lot of members that told me specifically that I think this is a wage that I can live with that means I don't have to leave Samaritan.
King says workers have dealt with a number of tragedies in recent years, including the pandemic and 2020 wildfires. Their new contract also expands education funding. Rachel Eggleton is a certified nursing assistant at the hospital. She says workers rallied over Memorial Day weekend when contract negotiations stalled, and the community members showed their support.
Once they saw us out in the rain rallying, they realized, okay, maybe there's something wrong. Maybe we need to help out our healthcare workers because they've been there through thick and thin for the entire pandemic. Regardless of whatever's happening, we still provided the care that they needed.
Eggleton says this support has been key.
Getting everybody involved and getting the community involved, it will always bring us better things.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Reported coronavirus cases in Oregon jumped 32% last week compared to the week before. The state is now averaging about 1,700 daily cases, the highest amount since February, with reported case numbers significantly less than the actual amount because of at-home testing. Nine Oregon counties, including Hood River, Lane, and Douglas, are currently in the CDC's high category for COVID spread. These counties have indoor mask recommendations in public places. Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties are in the medium range, with people at high risk of severe infection encouraged to talk to a healthcare provider about masking. The number of people hospitalized to testing positive in Oregon also jumped in the past week, reaching 357. Due to more cases of the highly contagious Omicron variant. As Portland's tree canopy declined, the city is ending its contract with Friends of Trees, a nonprofit that has planted around 40,000 street trees in the city in the last 14 years. A new analysis shows the tree loss is the highest in neighborhoods where people died during the heat dome. Portland's tree canopy decreased by more than 820 acres, a rough equivalent of two Washington parks of shade between 2015 and 2020. This figure doesn't include recent tree losses due to last year's ice storm and heat dome. Yasher Vasef, executive director of Friends of Trees, said, quote, "We're disappointed we can no longer have the grant-funded community planting events. The city should be doing what it can, as well as working with Friends of Trees and other organizations," end quote. The city will expand its own tree planting program, but it's uncertain if it will match the volume of the Friends of Trees or the group's well-established relationships with underserved neighborhoods. The first wildfire of the season in Oregon is now burning in the eastern part of the state near Vail. It's been dubbed the Willow Creek Fire, and in just a day, it has consumed 40,000 acres. The Bureau of Land Management says the blaze started on private land and has since moved to land controlled by their agency. As of this morning, the wildfire is 0% controlled. Officials remain optimistic, however, with crews from Southeast Oregon and Southwest Idaho working on containment. Winds and cooler conditions overnight help to improve the firefighters' positions. The official cause of the fire is unknown. The House January 6th committee held a hearing yesterday, with the star witness being former aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Cassidy Hutchinson. Hutchinson testified that after his speech to the crowd on January 6th, President Trump tried to grab the wheel as he was being driven back to the White House rather than to the Capitol as he had wanted. Here's what she said before the committee.
Tony proceeded to tell me that when the president got in the Beast, he was under the impression from Mr. Meadows that the off-the-record movement to the Capitol was still possible and likely to happen, but that Bobby had more information. So once the president had gotten into the vehicle with Bobby he thought that they were going up to the Capitol, and when Bobby had relayed to him, we're not, we don't have the assets to do it, it's not secure, we're going back to the West Wing. The president had very strong, very angry response to that. Tony described him as being irate. The president said something to the effect of, I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now. To which Bobby responded, sir, we have to go back to the West Wing. The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel. We're going back to the West Wing. We're not going to the Capitol. Mr. Trump then used his free hand to lunge towards Bobby Engel. And when Mr. Renato had recounted this story to me, he had motioned towards his clavicles.
And was Mr. Engel in the room as Mr. Renato told you this story?
He was.
Did Mr. Engel correct or disagree with any part of the story for Mr. Renato?
Mr. Engel did not correct or disagree with any part of the story.
Did Mr. Engel or Mr. Renato ever after that tell you that what Mr. Renato had just said was untrue?
Neither Mr. Renato nor Mr. Engel told me ever that it was untrue.
That was former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson testifying yesterday before the House January 6th committee. After her testimony, Secret Service agencies disputed Hutchinson's account, saying Trump was furious, but did not try to grab the wheel or assault an agent, and offered to testify under oath. More damning in Hutchinson's testimony was that Trump knew that many of those just outside his rally on the 6th were heavily armed, and that he wanted them allowed past the security scanning for weapons. He stressed that they wouldn't hurt him specifically. He also knew those armed protesters would be going to the Capitol, and he encouraged the crowd to do so. Lawrence Tribe, a Harvard law professor, said the new evidence against Trump was, quote, devastating for inciting, aiding, and abetting violent insurrection. He also said, quote, Trump, reluctance I abhor, failing to indict Mark Meadows along with Jeffrey Clark, John Eastman, Rudy Giuliani, and Sidney Powell would be a travesty, end quote. The committee will continue its investigation, and further public hearings may be scheduled for the week of July 11th. The January 6th committee learns former President Trump allegedly endorsed violence against then-President Pence. With more on the story, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
The rioters chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." The President of the United States, Donald Trump, said that, quote, Mike deserves it, and that those rioters were not doing anything wrong.
The January 6th committee held its sixth televised hearing yesterday, where Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney, the committee's vice chair, revealed that President Donald Trump allegedly endorsed the murder of Vice President Mike Pence. Former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson described how President Trump allegedly planned to travel to the Capitol during the attack and detailed his efforts to support the rioters. Corroborating previous administration officials' testimony, Hutchinson said the White House knew well in advance that violence was possible.
As an American, I was disgusted. It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. We were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie.
The Biden administration has rejected a proposal to place abortion clinics on federal land, an idea floated by progressive lawmakers to skirt state-level abortion bans. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters Tuesday there were dangerous ramifications to doing so, contending that women and providers who aren't federal employees may still be prosecuted under state-level bans. But Secretary of Health and Human Services Xavier Becerra says the feds are acting to increase abortion access.
HHS will take steps to increase access to medication abortion. Second, I am directing the Office for Civil Rights within HHS to ensure patient privacy and non-discrimination for patients seeking reproductive health care, as well as for providers who offer that reproductive health care service.
Becerra says the department will also direct the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to, quote, take every legally available step to protect family planning care. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's Democratic leaders are suing to overturn the state's 1849 abortion ban. Democratic Attorney General Josh Call says a 1985 law that guarantees access to abortions up to viability supersedes the 173-year-old law.
We've also argued that Wisconsin's abortion ban has fallen into disuse and can no longer be enforced under Wisconsin law.
The Supreme Court has made it more difficult for prosecutors to bring charges against doctors operating so-called pill mills. In its ruling, the court's justices gave two doctors, who federal prosecutors charged abused their medical license to overprescribe opioids, the opportunity to challenge their convictions. The G7 summit wrapped up yesterday. The focus of this year's meeting of world leaders was largely on the ongoing invasion of Ukraine by Russia. President Joe Biden says transatlantic unity is necessary to respond to Russian aggression.
We're standing as one to support Ukraine and to enhance our own deterrence and defense capabilities.
For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Jonah Chester.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth, interviewing Street Roots Kay Rambo about homeless sweeps and data collection. Then stick around at 5:45 for News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. Coming up this weekend is the Waterfront Blues Fest, which will be broadcasting live on KBOO all weekend long. We'll hear from the event organizer about what to expect. Tonight's weather will see a few passing clouds with a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 79. Today in history, in 1972, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Furman versus Georgia that arbitrary imposition of the death penalty violated the 8th and 14th Amendments and constituted cruel and unusual punishment. The quote of the day is from former Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, "So often in life, things that you regard as an impediment turn out to be great good fortune." Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma says the Supreme Court has failed in its duty to honor U.S. promises. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma says the U.S. Supreme Court has failed its duty to honor the nation's promises, defied Congress's statutes, and has disregarded tribal sovereignty. Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. made the statement following the High Court's ruling Wednesday, siding with Oklahoma, ruling the state can prosecute non-Native Americans when the victim is Native American for crimes on tribal land. The 5-4 decision undercuts the court's own 2020 landmark McGirt ruling, which reaffirmed reservation boundaries and held the state did not have jurisdiction. Hoskin expressed disappointment in Wednesday's ruling, but said it does not diminish the tribe's commitment to public safety and that tribal and federal jurisdiction remain unchanged. Hoskin also affirmed unchanged reservation and tribal sovereignty. U.S. Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough has officially recognized the Navajo Nation Veterans Administration as a tribal veteran service organization. It meets the standards to be accredited under a VA tribal program, which helps veterans with benefits and claims. During a visit to Gallup, New Mexico on Tuesday, McDonough recognized the tribe. His remarks were streamed live by the Navajo Nation President's office.
They are the first tribe to take up this new authority, and thrilled that we can announce that today, and as importantly, put it into action to ensure that we are living up to our obligations.
Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez called it a milestone achievement and a big step forward for Navajo veterans. 5 Navajo Veterans Office staff members are accredited to process claims. The accreditation allows employees to represent claims on behalf of veterans. Before, Navajo veterans would have to travel to VA centers off the reservation. More than 80 claims have been filed since May. According to the tribe, there are about 10,000 Navajo veterans. Navajo leaders say there's a need for a veterans outreach center and hospital on the reservation to provide services and health care. Gallup, a reservation border town, has one of the closest community-based outpatient clinics. It was one of 4 clinics in the state facing closure. The VA and members of New Mexico's congressional delegation announced this week all four clinics would remain open. The California State Senate Public Safety Committee approved the Feather Alert Bill Tuesday evening. The bill was introduced by Native American Assembly member James Ramos. It would create a state endangered missing advisory system for Native Americans. Creating an alert system was a recommendation from tribal leaders who joined Ramos and advocates before the committee hearing Tuesday at the state capitol in Sacramento. Ramos talked about his bill as a tool to address missing and murdered indigenous people.
This bill brings further attention and effort to end violence on tribal lands and across the state of California. The rates of murdered and missing people in Native American communities is a shameful, state and national tragedy that does not receive the scrutiny and attention it deserves. We are excited about this alert system, but even more excited about the growing momentum, to tackle this issue, not only from Indian country, but also by non-Native people like our collaborators here with us today, the California Highway Patrol and other law enforcement agencies, as well as the state legislature.
Ramos says California has the greatest population of Native Americans in the nation and is among states with high rates of reported cases of missing and murdered indigenous people. He says the alert system would help get the word out sooner when an individual is missing or endangered by asking the public for tips and leads as quickly as possible. The bill is supported by a number of tribes, urban Indian clinics, and Native business councils. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Big game species migrate, but face a variety of threats. Mapping their migration improves conservation, but those efforts, including work in Oregon, needs congressional funding. Eric Tegetthoff has more on the story.
Mapping migration routes is important for conserving species like pronghorn, so supporters hope Congress will fund mapping efforts. The United States Geological Survey has published two volumes on migration of ungulates, or hooved mammals, in the western United States. Michael O'Casey is the Pacific Northwest field manager for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. He says the second volume highlights Sheldon Heart Mountain pronghorn movements in southeast Oregon.
It shows this really neat connection between two of the first wildlife refuges in the country that were set aside for big game, specifically for pronghorn. The map in that volume two really highlights the need for connectivity between those two refuges.
The Biden administration zeroed out funding for wildlife migration mapping in its 2023 budget. Advocates for mapping hope Congress will set aside $5 million so USGS can continue work with state and local stakeholders on developing maps for big game species in the West. Matt Kaufman, a wildlife biologist with USGS, points out that migrating species are facing more obstacles in the form of fences, traffic, and development.
The mapping gives us a roadmap to identify the threats that the migrations face and also identify some of the conservation opportunities. And without a map, it's really difficult to proactively manage and conserve these migrations.
Kaufman says migrating animals travel across privately owned land, public lands, and tribal reservations, making management complex. But he says ungulate herds are important to western ecosystems, providing prey for large carnivores like wolves.
Most of them are also harvestable game animals, and the harvestable surplus that is produced by migration provides millions of dollars in revenue to the state wildlife agencies that manage those herds, and also billions of dollars in tourism revenue to wildlife viewers.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trust. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegetthoff.
Residents of Minnesota are transplanting seeds to help forest resilience. Dr. Anthony Lizowicz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowicz, and this is Climate Connections. In southern and central Minnesota, people are collecting seeds from red oak, river birch, and other local tree species. Then farmers grow these seeds into seedlings that will be planted in the state's northern forests. The project started with research by Julie Ederson of the University of Minnesota, Duluth. She says as northern Minnesota warms, it's becoming less suitable for cold-loving trees, like quaking aspen and paper birch.
And so about 10 years ago, we started this work where we took species that are predicted to do well with climate change, local populations, and populations from further south, and planted them up into the northeast corner of Minnesota.
She says the ones from seeds gathered farther south are growing faster and surviving better.
And so this experiment gave us confidence that this method of forest adaptation is actually a successful approach that might be more broadly implemented in our state to retain forest cover and increase forest resilience.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
United States Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, met with Pope Francis today and received communion during a mass in St. Peter's Basilica. Pelosi is Catholic, but is also a vocal supporter of abortion rights. Pelosi was seated in a VIP diplomatic section of the Basilica and received communion along with the rest of the congregants. Pelosi's home archbishop, San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione, said he would no longer allow Pelosi to receive the sacrament in his archdiocese. He has said Pelosi must either repudiate her support for abortion or stop speaking publicly of her Catholic faith. Pelosi has done neither. She has spoken about the Catholic virtues of faith, hope, and charity, and called the recent Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade an outrageous and heart-wrenching decision which fulfilled the Republican Party's, quote, dark and extreme goal of ripping away women's right to make their own reproductive health decisions, end quote. While Francis presided over the Mass, he did not distribute communion himself. Pelosi received the sacrament from one of the many distributing priests. Francis has rarely distributed communion, purportedly to prevent the sacrament from becoming politicized. Last year, President Joe Biden, another Catholic who supports abortion rights, said Pope Francis told him to continue receiving the sacrament. Francis has described the Eucharist as, quote, not a prize for the perfect, but a powerful medicine and nourishment for the weak, end quote. The Pope has been asked about U.S. bishops who wanted to refuse Biden the sacrament. Francis previously told reporters priests should not be politicians, but should be pastors who accompany the faithful with tenderness and compassion. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the future Pope Benedict XVI, told U.S. bishops in 2004 that priests must deny the sacrament if a politician persisted in manifesting grave sin, including the sin of consistently campaigning for permissive abortion laws. Pelosi met with Pope Francis on Wednesday before the Mass and received a blessing. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael feels an avalanche of crumbling freedoms.
Authoritarianism requires silence and fear. Our democracy has always been a house of cards, a gentleman's agreement, an illusion. This constitution written by white male landowners who have never been a majority, maybe 40%, enough to stop anything from passing in the Senate. It took decades to get this all crumbling down, and Roe's reversal is just the first gigantic boulder in the avalanche. What's next? The Democratic Party establishment is just as addicted to donors and power as the Republicans. They just give us longer leashes and smile more. Authoritarianism requires helplessness and distraction. That's why the powerful keep making our economic lives more desperate. Vital necessities we can only get by competing with each other. Maybe I'll binge-watch The West Wing and tell myself American government used to work like that. Maybe the next Star Trek spinoff will talk about those who didn't qualify for the Academy and can't afford replicators for food. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The co-producers are myself, Josh Salem, and Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Jonah Chester, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking today with Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief of Street Roots. Welcome, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Today, I want to talk to you about Street Roots' Sweep Tracker project, since it incorporates community involvement to gather data on homeless sweeps. But before we get into how it's been going, how is this kind of data usually kept?
Yeah, so aside from the sweep tracker, we know of, you know, a number of orgs that kind of maintain informal lists that allow them to, you know, distribute resources to unhoused folks who may be facing a sweep. The main avenue for this data comes from the city itself, specifically from the Homelessness and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program, which is generally shortened to HUCR somewhat mercifully, which is housed in the city's Office of Management and Finance. So HUCR is responsible for the majority of sweeps, and they are also responsible for recording that data, ensuring it's accurate, and publishing it in a weekly report.
So how come it's so important for Street Roots to create an alternative record with this sweep tracker?
Part of it was really from our experiences reporting and using that data, reporting on homelessness and using the city's data, and finding that, you know, there are certainly some clerical errors that we found with